Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Middle East Studies. I'm James Dorsey, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Alessandro Arduino, who is the co-editor together with Jue Gong of Securing the Belt and Road Initiative, Risk Assessment, Private Security, and Special Insurances along the New Wave of Chinese Outbound Investments. It's a book that I've had the honor to contribute a chapter to. Alex, welcome to the show. And I wonder if you could begin a bit about telling us about yourself and how you came to edit this book.
First of all, James, thank you very much for having me today and for hosting me in your podcast. We have been working for quite a long time with Jue Gong, co-directing the book on security on the Belt and Road. And I take the advantage now to thank you for participating in a chapter on the book with several other very important authors and academicians that have been working with us on the topic. Basically, I've been interested in researching on the security on the Belt and Road Initiative since its inception in 2013, when President Xi launched the overall idea of that was at the time not even called One Belt, One Road, and what now has been more widely known about Belt and Road Initiative. Before that, my research were focused on socioeconomic development of Chinese investment outside of China, especially related to CIC, China Investment Corporation, as a Chinese sovereign wealth fund. But slowly I've been moving from more financial focused analysis on non-financial area, and especially one on security. A previous book of mine that was focused on that aspect was related basically to one question: how Beijing was going to provide security for Chinese personnel and infrastructure along the Belt and Road. At the time, the title of the book was China Private Army, Protecting the New Silk Road. And nowadays, the question is not only, in my personal opinion, quite important, but it's renewing and it's evolving along the time as the Belt and Road Initiative is evolving quite fast as well. Basically, in my previous research, I was looking at the fact of how the Chinese private security company are evolving from local security operating in China to international company able to maneuver in a very high risk area abroad. In this respect, I've been doing research in the past in the interaction between private military, private security, as well as the impact of financial and non-financial threat and risk to foreign investment. And in this respect, our latest book, Securing the Belt and Road Initiative, present an array of problem of risk and way to manage and appraise this risk along the Belt and Road Initiative. And as I mentioned early, is not only related to the fact that most of the risk can involve a financial problem ranging from economic crisis and currency devaluation, asset nationalization, just to name a few. But then there is also a non-financial risk component that is extremely important and has to be assessed. And the book focuses on that. I spend most of my researching time in mainland China. I've been for more than 20 years in the People's Republic of China. In the last 4 years, I've been very lucky to have the chance to co-direct a program that now become a center at the Shanghai Academy of Social Science with the support of the University of Torino. And now with the support of the Polytechnic of Torino. We have been researching security and crisis management, mostly for SOE, the Chinese state-owned enterprises going abroad, and the impact that these investments have in several areas along the Belt and Road. One of the areas that we looked at more was Central Asia, and slowly we are moving also to South Asia in areas like Pakistan and Afghanistan. But all over the Belt and Road Initiative, we are looking at a way to have proper risk appraisal and risk mitigation. Another part of my previous research, as I mentioned before, was mostly on economic, and now slowly is moving to defense economic and non-traditional security. So that it, in a nutshell, I hope to have covered your first question.
It's an impressive record. Before we get into the security issues themselves, let's just talk for a minute about the Belt and Road Initiative itself. At the very outset of the book, you talk about the goals of the initiative, and you mention connectivity, unimpeded trade, financial integration, but you also mention policy coordination, which raises the question of what the Belt and Road Initiative really is about, and whether or not it in many ways is not an attempt to create a cornerstone for a new world order.
Yeah, on this, I think it's quite a compelling and very debated problem up to now. In the name itself, in the English translation of Idai Lu, we find already what is the Chinese proper point of view, Belt and Road Initiative. It's into that. It's an initiative. It's not something that can be called a Marshall Plan, as there is no political intent from the Chinese side. While from other part of the world, the reading has been quite different and in several parts almost opposite, as I have to say, because the Belt and Road is not considered an initiative, but is considered not even a strategy, but a grand strategy. So when the influx of Chinese money, Chinese worker is moving along the Belt and Road, in some area there are some questions of possible hidden agenda from the Chinese side. At the moment, most of the area in which these investments are involved is just a matter of fact of renegotiating what have been done in the past in terms of grant, in terms of swap, in terms of financing, and what are the return. From my personal point of view, definitely there is something in the middle. So say the initiative is evolving pretty fast, and the Chinese diplomatic economy is having and is going to have a long-standing repercussion on international order. Having said that, I'm not precisely pointing if it is just an initiative or a grand strategy, but no matter what, in my personal opinion, the Belt and Road Initiative, it is a game changer. And then it's going to affect not only economics, but also policy and politics.
Securing personnel and investment would obviously fall partly into the notion of a larger geopolitical scheme. And indeed, in many ways, does create building blocks for a new world order. In that context, I want to look at your definition of security, which in terms of threats is defined in the broadest sense of the word. So with other words, instability, religious and ethnic tension, fragile legal infrastructure, political risks, criminality, environmental degradation, and social in terms of lack of corporate social responsibility. Perhaps you want to elaborate on what really the threat matrix is to Chinese investment overseas.
Yes, as you mentioned, basically these are all overall all the non-financial threat that Chinese corporation acknowledge in the risk associated with outbound direct investment in emerging economy. There is up to now a quite high rate of failure due to this kind of risk. One of the basic problem that we found during our research is the fact that with some notable exception in terms of the Chinese state-owned enterprises in the energy and ICT sector, a lot of Chinese SOE, due to their public nature and commercial capacity, tend to blur the lines between commercial and political factor. And this is quite a big issue because they always think in one term that their contract and their procuring or their investment and infrastructure is too big to fail. And no matter what, Beijing is going to come in support. And especially in case of crisis, make it not only a financial crisis, but a crisis that erupt for violence, maybe criminal or political violence, still there is the too optimistically presumption that Beijing is going to support in case of crisis. In the past happened, in the future definitely is not going to happen so often. There was a recent call by Sinosure talking about the Chinese investment in the railway electrified line between Djibouti and Addis Ababa. And the loss that was incurred was a lesson to the fact that Beijing is not going to finance unreliable or not efficient project in the future. The same call was made by President Xi Jinping himself just a few months ago. Back to the security threat matrix, basically, as you mentioned, one part that is quite important in some time, terrorism or criminal violence is overrated, while the need for environmental protection, corporate social responsibility, it's quite important, not only during the project planning and planification, but also during the project when the state-owned enterprises and the private company are involved in the construction. Just to make an example, if you look at a small area, even a remote area, in which a Chinese road or railway have to cross, and then there is a sudden influx of 100 or even 1,000 of Chinese workers, mostly male, then there are constraints on that area, food supply, resources, and then there can be friction with the local population. This is one of the area that we are researching, and we are looking forward to have more suggestion in terms of policy recommendation.
In terms of defining the threat matrix, it strikes me that one of the issues also is the nature of the investing party. So with other words, you're talking about state-owned enterprises that, for one, do not have the kind of shareholder accountability that private enterprises have, but also because there's a partly political element to this, they're often willing to take on have a far greater risk appetite. So with other words, areas of conflict, of instability, of fragile political and legal infrastructure, they are willing to invest where maybe private enterprises would not.
Yes, this appetite for risk, it's quite a problem in some respect, because some of the time is not only the area in which the investment is going to be localized, because probably is an area considered by Western counterpart to higher risk, but some of the time is why these companies, state-owned enterprises, decide to invest on that area. Sometimes, as I mentioned, is not the final area of investment, but it's just the fact to achieve and to obtain a preferred loan from the Chinese state investment bank, China Development Bank, Bank of China, Exim Bank, and so on. So sometimes it's a national internal interest of the SOE just to let the company produce worker, to have even more worker inside the company. And then they find an excuse to go out and invest out in an area that is too high risky to invest, or they probably don't have the necessary capacity to evaluate that kind of risk. So this creates an appetite, as you mentioned correctly, for high risk. That is something that in mainland China is going to change. There is a lot more scrutiny, not only from the bank side or the credit insurance side, as I mentioned before, like Sinosure, but the central government body who are in charge of looking at this kind of project, basically NDRC and SASAC. In the past, and sure, in some way also in the future, we can say that the government support for the Belt and Road Initiative is a long-term guarantee that China will sustain this infrastructure development and connectivity vision. But at the same time, the notion of unreliable support of investment project is quite different if we look it from a Chinese public context point of view and from a Western liberal market perception. From a Western poor point of view, some of these projects do not present a financial viability. They don't have an expressed return of investment, for example, in standard, while an SOE can see different kind of return. As I mentioned before, exporting industrial overcapacity, letting the worker increase the production locally that cannot be reversed in the Chinese internal market, and so on. And of course, on the long term, this kind of project, if played good, could have a political impact.
You talked about the security risks involved in the way that, in a sense, the Chinese do business. With other words, reliance primarily on Chinese labor, often reliance on Chinese raw materials. And the question that I've often had in my mind was whether or not the Chinese had really drawn or learned the lesson from Libya in 2011, Libya being the first time that the Chinese had to evacuate a large number of Chinese nationals, 35,000, because of the popular revolt in the country at the time. And that sort of was what sparked the realization that China needs to provide security for its people abroad, as well as for its investments. But there was another aspect to the Libyan event, and that was that in the immediate aftermath of the fall of Libyan leader Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, the Libyans really said to the Chinese, you are at the bottom of our list because you continuously had and supported the Gaddafi regime. So with other words, the political risk that's involved in the policy of non-interference.
Yes, into that, I think I can link with another example. Is another evacuation quite successful made by the People Liberation Army Navy that was in Yemen after. The problem was to evacuate a large number of Chinese workers overseas. A large number of workers, some of them were not even accounted due to the difficulty of mapping them by the Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs. In this respect, one of the most relevant issue that was in the past and is up to now, because China is not changing much the pattern of investment that include the use of Chinese worker and even Chinese material on the area in which they are invested. And the issue, as I mentioned several times in the book, is how to provide security for Chinese personnel and infrastructure along the Belt and Road. One of the realization, as you mentioned, was with the fall of Muammar Gaddafi regime in Libya. But also one wake-up call, a turning point in my position, was at the end of 2015 when three Chinese officials from China Railway were killed in a terrorist attack in Bamako by a local terrorist at the Radisson Blue Hotel, if I remind correctly. That was a wake-up call for Beijing to increase security without provoking any direct military intervention. So as you mentioned correctly, up to now, Beijing still stands by the decade-old non-interference principle. The principle of non-interference for China is one of the key five principles of peaceful coexistence that constitute the pillar of the Chinese foreign policy. Beside being quite old, it's also changing. It's changing very slow from something that now is being called, translated into English, in constructive involvement or even creative involvement. And definitely the evolution of the Belt and Road, both on the maritime road and Eurasian land mass, is already stretching the limit of the Chinese non-interference principle. In this respect, in my personal opinion, what China is doing with the Blue Helmet, especially with the UN security program in Africa and with the private security company, it's a way to narrow the gap between Chinese economic diplomacy that is expanding with the Belt and Road and the Chinese current security capabilities that are still in a dire need of upgrade. And back to the security dimension, basically in my previous research, I was trying to look at two questions in regard how to provide security for Chinese personnel. The first question was, is China and especially Chinese private security company an alternative to the PLA intervention? Is some problem like the one that you mentioned in Libya or the one in Yemen is going to erupt in the future, and there are hundreds, not even thousands of Chinese workers involved in a national crisis? Is PLA going to intervene, or there will be a private security aspect of it that is not going to infringe the Chinese non-interference principle? And then most importantly, as we still see that these investments are spearheaded from a public side with state-owned enterprises, if these private security are going to be loyal to Beijing or just protecting the agenda of the state-owned enterprises who hired them.
You mentioned Pakistan, where obviously a lot of these issues play. And in extension of that, the broader Islamic world and the question, and I realize this is a tricky question, but nonetheless, the question of whether or not Chinese policies domestically, particularly in the security area, and then again, particularly in Xinjiang, which is in many ways the starting point of the Belt and Road across Eurasia, whether or not those policies contribute to an enhanced security risk.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Into that, looking from the broader scope of the BRI, of course, stabilization and sustainable development of Xinjiang is of primary importance, not only for the Belt and Road itself, as it starts in the Kashgar area, going down to the city port of Gwadar in Pakistan. CPEC itself, its part is one of the flagship project along the Belt and Road.
Yes, and Pakistan Economic Corridor.
Correct. And it involves more than 60 billion planned investment. Into that, the Xinjiang part plays a very important role. From my point of view, that is the one of private security, it's quite interesting because a lot of mainland China's private security company that are interested to work in Pakistan supporting the security of the Chinese infrastructure and Chinese personnel are starting to employ Uyghur due to the fact that they speak in some area the local language. So for the private security area, there is much of chance of employment in that field. From the other respect, the internal policy, of course, it's reverberating not only in Pakistan or Afghanistan, but overall in all Muslim world with different impact. Having said that, the China-Pakistan economic corridor present basically in only one area all the kind of threat and risk that the Belt and Road Initiative faces, ranging from terrorist attack, criminal violence, interested in kidnap and ransom of wealthy Chinese, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, TIP, and so on. It's all present in that area as a threat to the project. On this respect, Islamabad has already pledged the intervention of 15,000 and more soldiers to protect Chinese investment in the area, while the Chinese private security firm are not allowed to carry weapon, but to act as a kind of security manager, something that definitely is going to speed up in a way or in the other the evolution process of the Chinese security firms.
We'll come back to the private security company shortly. I also want to look at one other broader aspect of the security risk, and that plays, for example, strongly in Balochistan, the Pakistani province where the port of Gwadar is. You talk in your book about the fact that Chinese projects often exacerbate longstanding border and other conflicts. And you mentioned, for example, with regard to Balochistan, if I'm not incorrect, opposition from India, but also from countries like Bhutan.
Yes, into that, basically, there are some cases, not only from the Baluchi one, but also the Sindhudesh with the Sindhudesh Revolutionary Army, in which China is not considered the main target, but is a byproduct of long-standing local problem that the Chinese investment are just increasing in terms of size and scope. As China is being locally perceived as a helper of the central government in Islamabad, and the perception is that the benefit of the Chinese investment are just going to be shared among Islamabad elite, then this is creating not the supposed win-win narrative of the Belt and Road Initiative, but some resentment along the local population, especially now in the coastal area, in the port of Gwadar and the one in Karachi. Not long ago, the local director for Pakistan of the biggest Chinese shipping line, COSCO, was just assassinated there, and probably was not criminal violence, but political violence. And then there is several other dimensions that have to be put more in a local context. And this is still missing when the Chinese SOEs are applying for investment abroad. Local consideration, local political culture, and the ongoing analysis of what the Chinese investment are creating in terms of local winner and loser, even in area where there are no direct threat to the Chinese investment, the sudden inflow of Chinese money that is going to benefit only few people in the area against, for example, other tribe or other population or other area, then, of course, is going locally to create winner and loser, creating resentment. And this resentment can mutate quite fast into violence against the Chinese worker.
All of this, of course, has led to the rise of Chinese private security companies. And one of the things that you note in the book is that there is, among Chinese companies, a lack of awareness of the threats and a lack of intelligence on the situation, and also a lack of experience and in crisis management practice. And what that has meant is, and that is all the more significant because more often than not, the issue is also lack of safety mechanisms. And you see that manifested in the fact that more often than not, deaths occur as a result of accident or disease rather than terrorism.
Yes, correct. Into that narrative. First of all, we have to say that what I was researching in my previous book, China Private Army, in mainland China, there are more than 5,000 companies amounting of more than 3 million security officials. But most of these security officials are just security guard. So basically, they are stationed in an area looking at the security of that area and are unarmed. Few of these 5,000 companies has already venturing outside, working in cooperation with international or with local security company. Several of these companies have already gained quite good experience. We are talking about a dozen compared to the 5,000. So up to now, the market for force in China is moving and evolving very slowly from security guard that work at municipal level to international companies that are capable and able to maneuver in a high-risk area. Pakistan is going in a way or another, as I mentioned earlier, to force this evolution to make it quite faster, because there is a need of professionalization in terms of intelligence gathering, use of proper intelligence, and of course, what it means manage security risk. Several problems are related to the fact that up to now, the Chinese market is still considered in the security part a bidding who is going to get won by the lowest bidder. So the security services that are being proposed are quite below standard, and only the few ones in terms of state-owned enterprises who understand the value of this service are the ones paying the good money, the real money for Chinese private security company who have reached this standard in order to operate abroad. In this respect, always, as I mentioned before, there is the problem that most of the company perceive Beijing as the last minute saver. In case of crisis, Beijing will support. So there is no need to pay expensive security procedure and measure upfront or even insurance. That's another thing that is quite important, the need for proper, not only credit insurance, but an overall security insurance and special insurance along the most high-risk area in the Belt and Road, not only to ensure infrastructure, but only to ensure against kidnapping and ransom the life of the Chinese and the local worker, as well as the proper policy to benefit the local population. Back to the security standard, the market is changing. There is still the perception in Beijing that there is need of evolution of the security guard, not only in terms of law, new law are going to be enacted soon, but in terms of security culture. By security culture, I mean there is still a very proper culture inside state-owned enterprises. And when they move abroad, they use the same mindset that they apply into mainland China. So, for example, most of the security company employ former PLA officials or PAP, People Under Met Police, former officer. So they are still used to obey to the leader without making any kind of contradiction if something is said or something in demand on the local area is going to need sudden change. But unfortunately, in the private security side, initiative is of primary importance from even one security officer. With the use to obey to the link, very structured of the SOE, it is very difficult for the Chinese security company to change their mindset and to enact fast enough and to be flexible to the local need. Another problem, as I mentioned, to the fact that still it's a race to the bottom in terms of bidding for the security contract, is the need of talent. You don't only need people who have military experience, there is a need of interpreter, of linguist, of intelligence official with capability to understand the local problem, as well as of expert in risk management and mitigation with corporate social responsibility capabilities. And of course, with an economy that is the Chinese economy, who is still under the new normal, increasing at 6% GDP per year, there is an ample offer of good job in mainland China. And then the question is why someone have to go abroad in very high risk area, being Chinese with the chance to find a better paid job in Shanghai or in other big Chinese city.
You describe this development as a shift away from Western private security companies to what you term Chinese private security companies with Chinese characteristics. Can you sort of define what those Chinese characteristics are?
Yes, as I mentioned before, the new Chinese private security environment is different from the private military private security environment that we were used just a few years ago. And I refer especially to the deployment of private military security company during Iraq and Afghanistan conflict. From the Chinese point of view, there is no need for a support to the military because there is no Chinese military involved abroad at the moment. It's a matter of securing the life and the infrastructure of Chinese investment abroad. And in this respect, there is a new market for force and is the Chinese market for force. Of course, the part Chinese with Chinese characteristic into that, as I mentioned, one is the local business culture. The other is the fact that most of the Chinese company prefer to engage Chinese company instead of international foreign company, basically for linguistic reason. They speak the same language. Then if we want to look a little bit deep down, there is also the consideration that a Chinese private security can protect in a better way the IPR or the company strategy and the long-term vision compared to the foreign one that can disclosure this information abroad. And up to now, to the security, to the market for force, there is not only the market for force and the offer from the Western counterpart for bidding to the Chinese market, but also by other international players, such as the Russian private security forces.
With other words, what Chinese state-owned enterprises need is something that goes beyond, far beyond the securing physically Chinese nationals' assets and investments abroad.
Correct. There is the need of more holistic approach in considering first and foremost what are the risks in investment, in investing outside, how non-financial risk overlap with financial risk and create financial failure and project failure on the long term. As I mentioned before, several state-owned enterprises are already playing this game quite well, while others who are for the first time adventuring outside the Chinese border always overestimate the fact that being successful in China doesn't automatically translate to being successful outside China. So a proper risk analysis, risk appraisal, risk mitigation in terms of gathering intelligence of the local culture, the local need, the real threat matrix during the project appraisal, and most important, during the project development is going to create an environment that is going to produce benefit not only financial terms for the SOE who invest there or the Chinese private company and SMEs that follow along, but most important for the overall stakeholder who are involved locally with the Chinese investment. If this risk mitigation analysis and mechanism is not well tailored, then the problem are going to be extremely serious. And it not only means financial problem, but it could mean environmental degradation and at the end, even loss of human life.
And yet, you know, despite this explosion in the number of Chinese private security companies, we're seeing a continued dependence on Western or non-Chinese security companies, including one Russian company, because of the lack of expertise, the lack of skill, but also because Chinese nationals are barred from carrying weapons.
Correct. As I mentioned, it's an evolutionary process. This is changing. It's even changing pretty fast, but it's going to take, in my personal opinion, at least several years, if not even a decade, to have a professional Chinese-only private security company moving abroad. In this respect, again, in my personal opinion, it's quite interesting the fact that while there is this need for upgrading capabilities and for professionalization from the Chinese side, always there is a huge offer from the Western counterpart to this demand, not only in terms of international company providing security, providing analysis and so on, but also in terms of standard. Again, in my opinion, now it's the right time in which Western counterpart can provide and be the main actor in support the internationalization of the Chinese private security firm. For example, there is the Montreux document spearheaded by the ICOCA, who is the International Code of Conduct Association based in Geneva, that can support the evolution in terms of standard, giving clear guidelines. United Nations also can be one of the supporters in providing tools, guidelines, and internationalization with standard for the security firm, as well as to the state-owned enterprises in the way they can react to crisis along the UN standard. And even from the United States point of view, there is the ISOA, who is the local association of the security sector, who can provide guidelines and cooperation and benefit with their member to the Chinese counterpart. The biggest problem now is that the Chinese security with Chinese characteristic, it's evolving. If we are not able to shape this evolution in sustainable term, then the problem that will result without lack of professionalization of the Chinese sector can create incident along the Belt and Road that are not only going to be paid by Beijing, but all the stakeholders interested into that.
In this whole world of private security, we've seen with the emergence of the Frontier Services Group, the return of Eric Prince, notorious of days of Blackwater, when he was accused, or his organization was accused, of having killed a fair number of civilians in Iraq. You describe in the book the rise of Eric Prince again, as well as the fact that in China, the perception of Eric Prince and of what happened in Iraq is a very different one.
On to that, basically, the part on FSG and the involvement of the founder of the former Blackwater company, private military security, Eric Prince, with China, is more detailed in my book, China Private Army. In the book dedicated to the part that is played by FSG, Frontier Service Group is a joint venture between China CITIC and Eric Prince, who is the former founder and CEO of Blackwater Company. As you just mentioned, there is a different Chinese perspective. As I say, it's not the different perspective on what you call this Nizhur Square incident, in which several Iraqi civilians have been killed by contractors under Blackwater name. In China, in the security area, from some companies, not all the security company and not all the security practitioner, Eric Prince company, previously Blackwater, renamed to Academy and now XE, and now I think it's under the Constellis Group. The pitch made by Eric Prince that nobody died under his protection was a matter of professionalization that was at the time, and by the time I say more than 1 year ago, was very well welcome in Beijing. FSG then evolved doing some training with Beijing Training School. There is a mushrooming of training school for security, not only in the capital city, Beijing, but also in area like Shanghai and Shenzhen, in which there is a training of an armed official, giving them a more professional involvement in what is security risk management. Of course, FSG is not the only one. There are several other international companies based in China or working internationally with Chinese. But the fact that Mr. Prince attracted so much media attention during his involvement in Iraq and Afghanistan, and even now with his involvement in partial involvement in other area of the globe, then all the media reflector talking about China and private security also pointed in his direction. But then again, private military security and private security has been on stage always. It's just a matter of how much you want to look into deep and to find the data and who are the real player. The part of FSG was, again, more on the news just to the personality of Eric Prince and to the fact that even after the sellout of Blackwater, he has been able to be in the game up to now.
You also mentioned that in academic circles, there is an argument being made that the Blackwater model does not fit Chinese needs.
Yes, that claim was made by some colleague, local colleague, during several conferences that we had in the last years in China. And the fact that one was the overrated media attention that was devoted to that part of security. The second is that there is no Chinese involvement in war zone area, and there is no need for private military security support. And then some part of the overall machismo that surrounded the Blackwater guidelines, how they react in case of crisis, especially in Iraq, is something that for some Chinese security academician was too much against what is the Chinese non-interference principle, and to have a very low security footprint while moving outside China.
On another note, you argue that the rise of the Chinese private security companies is fostering innovation and adaptation of new technologies. Can you expand on that a bit?
Yes, on this, there is always the perception that private security is some guy armed with a Kalashnikov in front of a wall, protecting a gate. That's something that is changing. What is most need now is, as I mentioned several times during this interview, the need for a security appraisal in terms of intelligence, in terms of adapting to the local culture, local language, local habit, but also the new technology. And the new technology mostly are aerial drone reconnaissance, private use of drone, and not only the very expensive and difficult to maneuver drone, but also other kind of drone and blimps that can be used to gather security data and to alert in case of attack or probable incident that are going to be avoided just to the fact that this technology that now are quite cheap and broadly available can be used for the security aspect.
Which leads us into a very different area, which is the question of cybersecurity and the role that private security companies may or may not play in that.
Oh, I don't think it's a different area. It's very linked together, and some company who have offering service in mainland China, in order to avoid the growing competition of the sector, are already offering in mainland China cybersecurity. It is a service from cybersecurity range from the basic security to cyber forensic, to try to find hacker who are trying to breach the company or data theft made inside the company. Now, this company who already have these capabilities or are interested to acquire these capabilities are merging with a Chinese software security company. And probably, in my opinion, if not the coming year, but at least in the next year, are going to offer their service to the Chinese company abroad. Why I mean that? Because in several areas, not only the high-risk area, but other area in which the Chinese company invest, let's say in power grid, energy-related aspect or area, the merchant acquisition aspect of the investment is going to involve cybersecurity. Up to now, this problem has been a little bit undervalued, but in the near future, it's not only going to be a serious problem, especially with company investing in foreign bank, in foreign market, even if they want to develop a new fintech product related to blockchain technology, but also to the company who absorb other kind of very simple brick and mortar company that have data that have to be protected. Chinese cybersecurity law, it's very detailed in how Chinese company who mine or who have data about China interest or Chinese people are obliged to protect their data. Otherwise, they are liable. So this new security company who are upgraded in giving cybersecurity service, they are going to be at the front line of this problem, and they are going to be the first to benefit, economically speaking, of this new kind of security service. Definitely the price and the range of money involved is not there yet at the moment, but as I mentioned before, in a few years it's going to be there.
One of the issues that you cite as hampering the development of the private security industry in China is the fact that there's no clear government address to which one can turn to. With other words, it's not clear who within the Chinese government is in charge of regulating, assisting the private security industry.
Yes, indeed, it's one of the main problems if we look at private security going outside China. Inside China, the guideline and the rules since 1993 to the 2010 new frame of law are very clear who is in charge and what the company have to do. But as soon as the company cross the Chinese border, then there is an increased amount of Chinese actors that are all involved, and basically they all claim some kind of paternity in devising the rules and controlling the private security. And among these actors, we can see the National Development Reform Commission, NDRC, who give the guidelines and approval of invest outside, SASAC, who is in charge of the state-owned enterprises investing outside China, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, that itself have to count and to take care of the Chinese national abroad, Ministry of Defense, and we can keep counting. The problem is that as soon as one of these ministries take the lead and take the overall paternity of the new framework of law and about the new guidelines, this is going to benefit the overall BRI security dimension. But again, this is one of the problem that it was underline at the beginning when the Belt and Road was launched is not only on the security aspect of the Belt and Road, but the big question at the 2013 after presidency speech at the Nazarbayev University in Kazakhstan launching the vision of the Belt and Road, the question was who is in charge of the Belt and Road? Is there any one window shop in which someone can refer to in order to have the clear guidelines? And it's something that started to come out with a white paper in 2015. But then again, there are several actors involved into that. And in specific, in the private security term, up to now, there is not still this one window shop in which one private security company in China or a foreign private security company can address all the problem in just one area.
Alex, the whole issue of the Belt and Road Initiative and the security aspects of it in the broadest sense is a subject that we could discuss for hours, and it's fascinating. But unfortunately, we're slowly coming to the end of this podcast. But before I let you go, perhaps you can describe what you are working on now and where you're going with this whole thing.
Yeah, thank you for the question. Basically, I'm moving not only my focus on private security concern. Still, the research is based on non-financial threat along the Belt and Road Initiative. And I'm looking at how Chinese state-owned enterprises, considering their own peculiar public value, can mitigate risk and can afford to make new tools for risk appraisal and risk management in several specific areas. My area of research now, mostly, as I mentioned earlier, is Central Asia, but also I'm looking what Chinese companies are doing in the Middle East and North Africa area, because in that area there is still a footprint that is state-owned enterprises, but there is also a very important part of investment that is led by Chinese private company. And this company have been there for a while, and they developed their own mechanism of survival in that area. So basically, I'm trying to study the impact of this non-financial threat on the financial reality of the investment.
Finally, can you describe whether or not there is a difference in impact on the part of state-owned companies and of privately owned companies, for example, in the Middle East and North Africa?
So you mentioned that we are running out of time. I think we will need more time to discuss this than to discuss the overall Belt and Road. Having said that, the line between SOEs and private sector in China is quite straightforward in terms, in legal terms. But then if we have to look at the evolution of the private sector coming from the public sector, then of course there are still now a lot of overlapping area in which personnel from SOE is borrowed to the public company or to the private company, sorry, or in which private company can leverage cooperation with SOE in order to have preferential line of credit that in other area are considered out of market line of credit. And in this respect, I think the question is very open, especially in the ICT sector.
Alex, as much as I would like to pursue this, I have to thank you for being on the show. This was a fascinating discussion. Thank you and goodbye.
James, thank you very much for having me. Thank you. Have a good day.